what I want to address tonight is not really a balance to it, as much as it gives, I think, us a perspective on what this world is really like. There's an old Chinese proverb that I've quoted for years and years and years, and it's, if you want to know what water is, don't ask a fish, because that's all that a fish knows. And if we want to know what is normal in terms of the world and government and power, we have lived during a very unusual time in the history of the world. Even though we think that our lifetime has been marked by wars, and to some degree it has, it hasn't been marked by wars like the history of this world typically has. And we can get, particularly around Christmas, very nostalgic. And I titled this address tonight, "It's Not Like the Christmas Cards." Christmas was not like the Christmas cards. The cards that we send show some very calm, quiet, sedate, pristine settings. And it gives you the impression that whether it's the shepherds on the hillside or the iconic three wise men and their camels just coming, you know, majestically and stately across the desert, which they didn't come across the desert. They would have died coming across the desert. They had to follow water like everybody else. I mean, camels can go a long way without water, but they can't go hundreds of miles without water. All of those kinds of things essentially get blown up when you study the history of what took place. And what I want to do tonight is take you to Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, where in this wonderful epistle of defending the gospel from Judaizers and from a works righteousness takeover, Paul is reestablishing the gospel as by grace alone, through faith alone. And it is in chapter 4 that he makes a very interesting statement. He says, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons." Now that phrase, "when the fullness of time had come," is what I want to just camp out on tonight. It speaks of at the exact moment in history when all of the things that God had ordered, lined up, ready to go, that's when He sent Christ. We are studying on Sunday mornings the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah's book is to the Old Testament what Romans is to the New Testament. It's the gospel of the Old Testament. Over and over and over, it just screams of Christ. But as we will see, Isaiah, in the early part of the book, is warning Judah against putting her trust in Assyria. Because there is going to arise a power after Assyria that will be the real nemesis of Judah. And that'll be Babylon. The Assyrian Empire, for all her cruelty, ruled the ancient Near East. And in order to stay in power, she had to just continually crush every rebellion that would come up. That's how you stayed in power. With any of these empires, the kings were always having to look over their shoulders as to who is killing them. It was either you kill or you would be killed. It gives you a real sense of understanding even the role that a guy like Nehemiah had as the cupbearer. Because as the cupbearer, he would sample what was in the cup. And if he didn't die, then it was okay to give it to the king. Well, about 626, Nabopolassar was a Chaldean general who was able to get control of Babylon. And he started to systematically destroy the Assyrians. But it was Nebuchadnezzar whom really spread the power of the Babylonian Empire. And while the Babylonians, which were south of Assyria, well, they're duking it out. All right? That diverted the attention from the southern kingdom. And so Judah was able to enjoy a little bit of respite. And but instead of using that time to really follow after God, even though they did that for a little bit of time, they became once again just blind to their own sin, full of their own devices, and the warnings of Isaiah and the other prophets, particularly of Jeremiah, who follows hard after Isaiah, and that the Babylonians are going to be the tool in the hand of God to bring about correction to His people. That finally came about. 606 BC, Nebuchadnezzar descended upon Jerusalem, and he basically gave them a warning shot over the bow. He took captive from their people some of the most promising young men. Daniel and his three friends were part of that. But Judah didn't respond very well. About 595 BC, Nebuchadnezzar had to come back and punish them again. And finally, in 586 BC, when Judah would not submit herself to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar finally came back, and this time he surrounded the city for about 18 painful months. Archaeologists have actually found a piece of sewer pipe dated back to that time. It's fascinating, and they have, you don't have to use your imagination here real far, they've actually examined the contents of that sewer pipe and were able to determine that the people during that time lived on plants, they lived on herbs, and it was they were full of disease of whipworm and tapeworm. It was a terrible, terrible time. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, so frustrated with the tenacity of the Jewish people holding out, that finally when he was able to break through the defenses and get into it, he was ruthless. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of the citizens who were killed. Those who were burned alive were actually received the best treatment. The gold was plundered from the temple along with its vessels. The killing was overwhelming. overwhelming, and he ordered the burning of that city. It was a large city, and it was burned, and the temple was burned, and those who remained were taken captive and deported to Babylon, with just a few that were left there in the region. There's a lot to say to that, but the Babylonian Empire would not last. One kingdom rises, another falls and takes its place. And eventually the Medes and the Persians would take over. And seemingly inexplicably, a guy, a king, ruler of the world by the name of Cyrus, who, by the way, was prophesied by Isaiah, ordered that the Jews be able to return back to Judah. And of course, the world is kind of a gap at that, because don't you know the rebellion of these people? Don't you know what they would do? But Cyrus orders this, and they go back in order to rebuild their temple. Even as the Medo-Persian Empire declined, it was Nehemiah who was permitted to return and rebuild the walls of the city. Meanwhile, a young king by the name of Philip II was amassing power in an area called Macedon, or Greece. And he raised up an army, and he was prepared to get revenge on the Persians because of what they had done to his own family when he, Philip II, was murdered. His 22-year-old son, Alexander, took over, and took over with a vengeance. Within 3 years, Alexander faced Darius III, and defeated him two different occasions and broke the power of the Persians. Esther's story, by the way, is in the middle of that whole business. And Alexander then headed toward Egypt. On his way to get to Egypt, there was a city called Tyre. Tyre, by the way, was a city that was out in the Mediterranean, just off the coast. And it was one of those cities that had a base on the mainland, but the main city was on this island. And they were so proud of the fact that, you know, being out on the water, it protected them, and they had a very elaborate defense system that enabled them to withhold anybody. And they taunted Alexander. He couldn't defeat them. And so what Alexander the Great did, he burned the city of the mainland, and then he took all the rubble and painstakingly built a causeway with the rubble all the way out to the island city. And meanwhile, Jerusalem and its inhabitants were, you know, they weren't real crazy about Alexander the Great. But once he, in his anger, not only wiped out Tyre, but then crucified all of her citizens, they decided that, you know, he wasn't, you know, we would be nice to him after all. And there's an old legend, I don't know whether it's true or not, but that the high priest met Alexander the Great and showed him from the book of Daniel that Alexander the Great was actually prophesied by God. And you read about his rise to power in Daniel chapter 8, pretty fascinating. But at any rate, Alexander the Great, really for all of his atrocities, spared Jerusalem for the most part. He was going to Egypt. That's where the money was. And after getting to Egypt, he founded a city. You'll never guess what the name of the city would be. Alexandria? Yeah. You know, everybody likes to name a city after themselves. And one of the things that is very intriguing, and I'm not going to get into it tonight, but is to see how any of the rulers of a particular region in order to curry the favor of the emperor. During the time of Christ, the empire seat was located in Rome, and so if you wanted to get the favor of somebody, then you would name something after the Roman emperor. So what had been the Sea of Galilee, you know, becomes named after Tiberius, you know, Sea of Tiberius, and other things like that took place all the time. And of course, it would just grind the locals, you know, because anyway. So Alexander names the city after himself and headed east from there to conquer, which he did. And he amassed in 10 short years a mammoth empire. He went as far as Pakistan, stretching the borders of his empire into the largest that the world had known up until that time. But on June the 13th, 323 BC, Alexander became sick, deathly sick, either a fever or poison. And there in Babylon, as his loyal soldiers wept and walked past him as he lay dying, he was asked, to whom would the kingdom go? And he simply said, to the strongest. What does that mean? Alexander had four generals. Two of them are featured very prominently in the story of Scripture. Two of them were prophesied in quite a bit of detail in Daniel's book, because those two would fight over Judah. It's not that everybody wanted Judah, it's just so happened that between the Seleucid general and his dynasty that ruled over in this region, and Ptolemy, the other general who ruled over in the Egypt area, in between the two of them was Judah. And so between the wars that went on, Judah was right smack in the middle. Ptolemy, the general who wanted to become king, and that's what everybody wanted. They wanted to replace Alexander the Great. And they all have to get money in order to pay their army and to do all that stuff. Ptolemy plundered the temple in Jerusalem. He pillaged Jerusalem. He raped the women. He took thousands of Jews with him into captivity. This time he took all of these Jews, instead of them heading east over here where they had been in captivity in Babylon, he took thousands of them into captivity into Egypt. And a lot of them settled in the city of Alexandria. Ptolemy would live into his 80s and would die, and his son, Ptolemy the II, took over, but he was favorable to the Jews. And he freed 120,000 of them to be able to return and go back to Judah. He even gave them gold to refurbish the temple. And he was not a moral man. In fact, he was actually a pretty decrepit person morally. But he did gain some begrudging respect of the Jews because of what he did. And he himself had a lot of respect for Jewish scholarship. And so he wanted Jewish works and writings to be translated into the Greek language, because this, when Alexander the Great conquered the ancient Near East, he was an ambassador for Greek culture and Greek architecture and Greek language and Greek music, and all of that stuff was spread over that entire area of the world. Well, interestingly enough, Ptolemy the II was fascinated with Jewish literature. Well, one of the main works, the main work of Jewish literature is what? The Bible, the Old Testament. And so he ordered that the Old Testament be translated into Greek, which it was. Now, there's a Jewish legend that 70 Jewish scholars each translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek in 70 days. And when they all got together at the end of the 70 days, they all discovered that they had translated the Bible exactly the same way. Probably not true. But that became some of the legend around the Septuagint. Okay? Septuagint, that is the Greek word for 70. All right? So which is the Old Testament translation of the Bible into Greek language, which took place around 275 BC, which, go back to Galatians 4:4, in the fullness of time. So what had God done at that point? He had raised up Alexander the Great, who had conquered the entire ancient Near East and had unified it, not politically, unified it in language. The Greek language became the language of the world, became the language of commerce. And Ptolemy II, unbeknownst to him, was setting the foundation for the spread of Christianity all over the ancient Near East by ordering the Jews to translate their own Bible into the Greek language. And so, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but 325 years later, when the New Testament is written, and is written in the Greek language, there is both Old Covenant, New Covenant, Old Testament, New Testament, already for the entire ancient Near East in their own language. When his son, Ptolemy III, died, which is around 240 BC, the dynasty was without a clear king. And that opened the door for the invasion of the Seleucids, led by a guy by the name of Antiochus. This king was expanding his version of Alexander's empire and trying to take control of it. He was benevolent to Jerusalem, and he succeeded in gaining the respect of the Jews, but he was unsuccessful in getting Greece. A new sheriff was in town. The upstart Romans had begun to make a name for themselves. And they not only defeated this Antiochus, but they forced him to surrender his fleet. He had a corps of elephants. I mean, can you imagine elephants? If you saw any of the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, and saw the elephants that would come marching in. And those were formidable forces that... anyways, there's some stories about how even the elephants would even turn on their own people from time to time. And that was all, you know, pretty interesting. But anyway, he had to surrender his elephant corps, his entire fleet, and he had to turn over his son to Rome, who was taken hostage. Antiochus, this ruler from the Seleucids, was assassinated shortly thereafter, and it paved the way for his son to take over, which he did, and his son was the Antiochus that Daniel prophesied about. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, which means Antiochus the Great One. He was a real humble guy, okay? And the Jews and others had a nickname for him. They called him Antiochus Epimenes, which means the madman. He was more of a madman. I mean, he was one of those guys that he was very, very skillful. But he was also crazy. He was dangerous, very dangerous person. He also desecrated the temple. What he did was almost worse than burning it. Ptolemy had invaded it, now Antiochus the Fourth, and he was so zealous for Greek culture and for the Hellenization of everything that when Antiochus the Fourth captured Jerusalem, he ordered that the Old Testament law be banned, and that anybody found obeying the Old Testament law to be executed. All sacrifices at the temple stopped. All services stopped. Anybody that obeyed the Sabbath was to be killed. Anybody that would circumcise their son, executed. He had the temple soiled with the flesh of pigs. He reconsecrated the temple to being a temple to Zeus. Many during his time would suffer death by crucifixion because of their commitment to the Sabbath. The Torah, the law, was publicly burned and torn. Anybody caught with a copy of the law would be killed. And what that did is that created within Jerusalem a huge, huge division between those who were loyal to Judaism and those who were going to be currying the favor of the Greeks. Now keep that in mind, because that really helps you understand Jerusalem even to this day. During the time of Christ, you had people like the Pharisees, very, very loyal, and you had the Sadducees, who were very, very influenced by modern, more liberal kind of thought. And they all existed within Jerusalem and were always at each other's throats. I mean, even to this day, Jerusalem is the home of three major world religions. And it's not unified. Never has been, never will be, till the king comes back. Well, Antiochus the Fourth left Jerusalem to be ruled over by a guy by the name of Menelaus, while Antiochus went back over here into the former Alexandrian Empire to try to amass greater power into himself. And the orders were clear: this Hellenization of this land was to continue to happen. And so Menelaus had his generals that would span out throughout the country. And what they would do is go into villages, and they would call the leaders of the village to a public sacrifice to Zeus. And if you were a leader, they would say, okay, you come and you offer the sacrifice to Zeus to show your loyalty. And outside of the city of Jerusalem, there was a little village, I believe it was called Modin. And there was an old man there by the name of Matthias. And he was ordered to offer this sacrifice in front of the other villagers. And he refused. And things got tense. Another villager stepped forward to offer the sacrifice, and this old guy was incensed. And pulling out a sword, he killed the traitor. Well, once you do that, okay, you got a problem. And he turned around and killed the general. He didn't last too long. But he had five boys. The third of his sons was a guy by the name of Judas. Judas was known as Judas the Hammer of the Maccabees. That was the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. And Judas eventually was able to gain somewhat of a control over Jerusalem. And this is about 164 BC. Now, within Jerusalem, there is this huge fortress. And that is where the armies of Antiochus and people loyal to him were there. And it was basically an impregnable fortress. But other than the fortress of Jerusalem, Judas and the army that he was able to amass was able to get control. Now, when he first amassed this ragtag band of soldiers, Menelaus was able to gain a bit of an army, and they attacked him, and he defeated them. Judas defeated them. In fact, he ended up defeating him three different times. And he gets to Jerusalem, and there, you know, the city is in such disarray. It's a very, very impoverished town by now. The temple is all overgrown. It's awful. There's, you know, no sacrifices have been offered for a very long time. And so Judas orders it to be cleansed and consecrated back to God, and the sacrifice is reenacted. Well, the story goes is that when they were cleaning up the temple and they wanted to light the candelabra there in the temple, that they only had enough oil for barely a day, but they lit it and it just burned and never went out. Now that became the foundation for Hanukkah, which is celebrated to this day. That the restart, the cleansing of the temple from the Seleucid kings. But what the Maccabeans went through. The first line, you know, the old man Matthias had those five boys, and they were able to gain a pretty significant following, and for a while, even at times when they would get power, the Seleucids would come in and it would look like they were almost to lose everything. I mean, there was an awful lot of battle and bloodshed that took place. The first line of the Maccabeans eventually died, and a son-in-law took over. But now all religious zeal for God and the Old Testament was gone. Now it had just really become all about power. The Ptolemies were clinging to power in Egypt. The Seleucids were holding to power in Persia. The Maccabeans were trying to hold on to power in Judah. And the Romans were advancing on the whole thing. Eventually, two brothers of Maccabean descent were fighting over power in Jerusalem. The Roman general who wanted to become emperor, a guy by the name of Pompey, who was incredibly successful on the battlefield, eventually came to Jerusalem, and he was happy to act like a peace broker between the two brothers. But in reality, Pompey was using that for his own. And another war ensued. And again, Jerusalem was ransacked. Again, the raping and the pillaging and the plundering and all of that stuff was going on. But not long after that, Pompey had troubles of his own back home. You see, Pompey and a guy by the name of Crassus, and another guy, have you ever heard of him, named Caesar? Okay? They were supposed to be sharing power. Because Rome supposedly was a republic. And as a republic, the Senate was very, very concerned when anybody was gaining too much power. Well, the way in which you gained power was by success in the battlefield. And Pompey was very successful on the battlefield. And so these three were supposed to be sharing power. Well, eventually, the Crassus and Caesar and Pompey were having at it by the, between themselves. And eventually Caesar would win for a while. But not before Caesar had gotten involved with Egypt. In fact, Caesar had chased Pompey to Egypt. Now, this is kind of gruesome. But just before Caesar got there, and he knew he was going to have a battle with Pompey, the Egyptians, trying to save their own cities, so to speak, they murdered Pompey. And they pickled his head, and they sent it as a gift to Caesar, welcoming him there to Egypt. Huh. Well, do you remember I said the Ptolemies were trying to hold on to power there? Very interesting. The guy who was king at this time was Ptolemy the 13th. I mean, there was a long line of them. And he was married to a girl by the name of Cleopatra, who everybody knows her name, but what they don't realize is that she was Cleopatra the 7th. Now, Ptolemy the 13th was trying to hold on to power in Egypt, and Cleopatra decided she could do just as good a job as he could. So even though she was his wife, she was battling him for power. So, when Caesar shows up, Cleopatra decides, my ship has just come in. And so she decides, if I can get him to become loyal to me, he will support me in trying to gain power here in Egypt. And so, how do you imagine she went about gaining his loyalty? Caesar fathered a son through Cleopatra. Never guess what his name is. Caesarion. Okay. Oh, by the way, do you remember during the time of Christ when he would go into the area of Caesarea? Okay. How did that get its name? You know, you have this guy named Herod who says, you know, I'd like to be in power, so hey, guess what I just did in honor of your birthday? This is now Caesarea. Those kinds of things, again, you know, just took place all of the time. So, Caesar and his new love, Cleopatra, everybody, they just used each other, but the Egyptians themselves were not real crazy about this, and so they were uprising against them. Caesar was about to get killed in Egypt. And back in Jerusalem, the Jewish leader was a guy by the name of Antipater. And he was in a bit of trouble himself because Antipater, in order to stay in power, had publicly stated how much of a supporter he was of Pompey. That's good as long as Pompey's in power. But when Pompey's pickled head shows up to Caesar, oh dear, you know, we got problems. So what Antipater did is he mustered up an army. And he went to Egypt. And he helped rescue Caesar and Cleopatra. from the Egyptians. And in so doing, he was able to gain the support of Caesar. Otherwise, Caesar would have, you know, executed him for having supported Pompey. So this grateful Caesar returned the favor by appointing Antipater power over all of Judea, along with his two sons, one by the name of Phasael, who was given rule over Jerusalem, and the other one received Galilee, his second son. And this is why I'm telling you all of this stuff. It was a guy by the name of Herod. When Herod received Galilee... Owen, how old are you? How old are you? 7 years old. When Herod started to rule, he was 15. 15 years old. And he was a fanatic. And he faced his first test. There was an uprising of some very zealous Jews. He had all of them killed. He was ruthless as a ruler. Anybody that got in his way, he would kill. Well, Caesar, who had gone back to Rome, and anybody remember what happened to him back in Rome? Okay. To Brutus, okay. There were Octavian and Brutus. Again, it was because he was amassing too much power, and the Republic couldn't have that. And so he was murdered there in Rome. And Cassius, I'm sorry, it wasn't Octavian, it was Cassius and Brutus. Cassius and Brutus that had murdered Caesar. And they were now making their way through Syria, but they were confronted by Caesar's great-nephew and adopted son. Caesar's great-nephew was Antony, and his adopted son was Octavian. And when they defeated Cassius, these two agreed to divide the Roman Empire that was becoming the empire between them. Antony got the east, and Octavian got the west. What that meant for Antony is that he had to face the Parthian Empire. Now, the Parthian Empire was more in the Iraq-Iran area today, or Babylon, and it was kind of a short-lived empire of about 50 years, but they were amassing some power. And Antony needed money to get an army together to be able to confront them. And Cleopatra, she had lost her supporter, Caesar. So she went to visit Antony. Anybody know anything about that? Well, she ended up getting twins out of that deal. And Antony got the money that he needed. But Cleopatra wasn't the only one that went and visited Antony. There was a guy by the name of Herod who had lost his supporter of Caesar, and he had gone to Antony as well in order to gain from him the appointment to be able to rule. And he received this royal appointment to be the ruler of, which was so important because Herod was a second generation Idumean. He was more from the, his bloodline was from the Edomites. He was not a Jew. And his mother was an Arab. Now, how do you think the Jews felt about this being our king? I mean, they never would accept this guy. And so he was always trying to find something that would make him the king. He wanted to be the king so bad. So he was always going through these sorts of things. Well, when he got this royal appointment from Rome, that he was finally, you know, announced as the king, he celebrated this by being engaged publicly to a girl by the name of Miriam. Now, Miriam was the granddaughter of two Maccabean kings. So it was like, if I can't be legitimate myself by my bloodline, I'll at least marry into it. So maybe then you will accept me as your king. Well, when Antony followed Cleopatra back to Alexandria, the Parthians made their way all the way over to here, and they invaded Syria. There was a guy by the name of Antigonus who was a legitimate Maccabean, and he seized the opportunity in Jerusalem for power, because he figured if the Parthians take over, then they're the ones who will say who's in charge, not Rome. So he sent 1,000 talents of silver to the Parthians, along with 500 girls from Jerusalem, in exchange for them installing him as king in Jerusalem. To which Herod, who had been appointed king, you know, didn't take to that too kindly. But the Jews were much more sympathetic to Antigonus doing this than they were to Herod, because at least Antigonus had the bloodline. Well, that was about 38 BC. Antony, remember him in Alexandria? He's fighting the Parthians. And Herod, having mustered up an army, was trying to figure out how to invade Jerusalem and take back the capital of the country that the Romans had said he could rule. Antony got in trouble fighting the Parthians. Herod took his army, helped Antony out, and Antony returned the favor by loaning Herod 30,000 troops and 6,000 infantry. Herod took that army and he came to Jerusalem, and he laid siege to Jerusalem for 40 days. That ended in another invasion, another slaughter of the city. Herod regained power by force, and he killed, in the Sanhedrin, of the 71 members, he killed 45 of them. He was now king, but he was not without challenges. Remember, Herod was engaged, now married, to Miriam. She was Maccabean. Miriam was pretty young when she married Herod. She had a brother named Jonathan. Jonathan was a true Maccabean. And Miriam had a mother by the name of Alexandra. Alexandra hated Herod. I mean, you talk about the mother-in-law. She was the mother-in-law. She hated her son-in-law because he didn't have the right bloodline. I mean, quite honestly, the guy was nasty. He really was. So Alexandra conspired with her daughter Miriam against Herod. And between the two of them, they tried to get Miriam's brother, Jonathan, to be recognized as king by Rome. And they were appealing to Antony to do this. And so the word came from Antony to Herod that he wanted him to send Jonathan to come see him. Well, Herod, guy's paranoid. Now, he was scared to death. He wouldn't let Jonathan go. But Jonathan was a very, very striking young man in his appearance. And anybody that was striking like that in appearance was viewed to be favored by the gods. And he was the ruler that the people in Judah wanted, not Herod. And he was of the Maccabean bloodline and so forth. So Herod, now he's got this Jonathan problem. What does he do with this guy? Everybody wants Jonathan. They don't want Herod. So trying to keep, you know, it's like the old mafia thing. You keep your friends close and you keep your enemies closer. Well, that's what he ends up doing with Jonathan. And so he appoints Jonathan as high priest. You know, it's not, has, by this time, it has nothing to do with whether you are in the tribe of Levi or anything. It's all a political game. And so he appoints him as high priest. Well, that turned out to be a colossal disaster because Jonathan now, arrayed in the high priestly garb and at the Feast of the Tabernacles, which is, you know, one of the biggest events, you know, is publicly with great entourage offering a sacrifice, and the whole place just goes bananas over him. And so Herod realizes he is in trouble. So he invites Jonathan to come to Jericho to his summer palace. And the story goes, it was a hot, steamy night there in the desert. Herod has one of his pools in which he, you know, tells Jonathan, hey, it's so hot, you know, why don't you cool off by taking a swim? Persuades him to do that. Of course, what Jonathan doesn't know is a couple of Herod's henchmen are hiding in the pool. So Jonathan goes in to take a swim. They grab him while he's in the water, pull him under, and don't let him go till he is dead. Well, you can only imagine how Jonathan's mother and sister responded to that. They are incensed. Miriam, his wife, would, I mean, she would mock Herod's, Herod had a sister by the name of Salome. And Miriam would just mock her because Miriam had the Maccabean bloodline, but not Salome. Miriam would also let everybody in the court know when she was withholding herself from the king. And would just mock him openly about it. But then, when they would make up, it would be very public as well. I mean, it was just the games that would go back and forth. And then Herod would respond by getting a harem, and he would marry others, and it was just nasty, nasty stuff that was going on. In fact, Herod ended up with a harem of about 500. He had kids galore. And then the stories of the multiple mother-in-laws that he had, and all of the power and the infighting and everybody manipulating to try to get their one in power and all of that stuff that took place. It finally all came to this point where Herod became so paranoid over Miriam, and with good reason. He had her killed. His own wife killed. And he eventually had his mother-in-law killed. Not long after that, there were four of his closest friends that he had suspected of being involved in the treason. He had them killed. Two of his sons had been sent to Rome to be educated. These were two sons from Miriam. When they came back from Rome, they were pretty full of themselves. And picking up the cause of their mother, they began to assert themselves as the legitimate king instead of their father, because now they had the Maccabean bloodline and not their dad. So Herod had them killed. He'd kill anybody. In the fullness of time, God sent forth his son. It was this Herod who was on the throne when Augustus, the Caesar, and who ordered the census be taken in order that an appropriate record be made of the empire in order to properly tax the whole empire, when in the middle of all of this chaos and killing, while an illegitimate king who could only hold on to power through killing many of the members of his own household was sitting on the throne, is visited by three, we presume, because of the three gifts the scriptures don't say, wise men from the Parthian Empire, who were saying, we heard that a king has been born. You gotta understand what was going on was so unstable. Herod, as you know, famously reacted to that news, doing what Herod always did, killed any threat that he perceived to be near him, which he did. The kids, little ones in Bethlehem. God rescuing his own son, who went to Egypt, where there were Jews. It seems odd to us. Why would he go to Egypt? There were Jews that were there. Still there. There was a place there. Herod would eventually die. And he'd be replaced. And the political intrigue would continue. And Christ, whose life and ministry would offer a kingdom so radically different than the Jews had experienced. I mean, they had been invaded over and over. Jerusalem had been burned. The temple had been pillaged. The people had, I mean, just the amount of devastation that has taken place in that city, even up to that point, is just phenomenal. When Christ was formally presented as the king on what we call Palm Sunday, and that evening, he went out and wept over the city. He did so because he knew that what was about to take place. Christ was our dates are probably off by about 3 or 4 years. He was probably born around 4 BC, according to our calendars, and probably died around 29 or 30 AD. So it was just 40 years after that, 70 AD, when the Roman general Titus would surround the city. There's a relatively new book that has come out on the city of Jerusalem, and it opens up with a description of the fall of the city into the hands of Titus, who was the Roman general at that time, who went on to become emperor of the Roman Empire. And his description, piecing together historical recounts, a good bit of dependence upon Josephus and so forth, are just unspeakable in what took place in that city. And, you know, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city in 586, by the way, it was on the exact same day that Titus finally broke through hundreds of years later and destroyed it. The Jews were seemingly forever gone from Jerusalem. I mean, what Rome did to Israel, what Rome did to Judah, what Rome did to Jerusalem, no one would have ever thought, ever, that there would be a return. As I said, you know, if you want to know what water is, don't ask a fish. But for many of us, we've grown up with, oh yeah, there's Israel. 100 years ago, nobody was talking about, here's Israel. It wasn't there. Oh, it was a place of history, but it was not a place of contemporary stories. And today, this little country, at one point in her geography, she is only, I think, 7 miles wide. That's how narrow this country is at one point. It's not a big country. There's hardly a day goes by you don't hear news coming out of Jerusalem. It's the focal point of the world. When Rome invaded, the Greeks gave us the language, the Romans gave us the roads. They built the roads, and they built them. Yeah, I know. We could use them here in Michigan. Because they built them to last. And there, some of those roads are still intact today. And why did Rome build the roads? So her armies could be able to travel from one place to another quickly to enforce the peace. Well, that's what Rome thought. Who traveled over those roads? Paul, missionaries. And what did he take? The Bible in the Greek language to the people. And that's all this. In the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son. When everything just lines up exactly how he wants it. And he has always done things right on schedule. And right on schedule, his Son will return and take back that which belongs to him. And we live in times really like everybody else. They're turbulent. They've always been turbulent. If you get a few years where there's relative calm, that's unusual. Be grateful for that. The history of this world is full of chaos and plunder and killing. It is a kindness, an undeserved kindness of God, that we have any measure of peace whatsoever at all. Most of it is just full of disaster, which we should expect. But it was into this chaos and into this darkness and into this mess that God sent His Son to do what we could not do for ourselves. And He will send Him back, this time not on a donkey, but on a white horse, to take back that which belongs to Him. But those in His kingdom will only be those who with gladness of heart bend their knee before His throne, acknowledge Him as Savior, Redeemer, and King. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of His Son, good Trinitarian statement right there, into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So, you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Father, as we just enter into the thickness of this Christmas season, so easy for us to not appreciate the chaos, the intrigue, paranoia, the circumstances of the first entrance of Christ. We recognize that all that was going on then is really no different than what goes on now. We are a people who are incapable of ruling ourselves. We are a people who can't even fix our own hearts. Oh, thank You for Your mercy to us. Thank You for providing a Savior. And we thank You that even what looks to be like chaos is under the sovereign hand of God, and that You are carrying out Your plan in detail to bring about the final and consummated kingdom and glorious enthronement of Your Son and our Savior. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. In whose name we pray. Amen. Hope I didn't ruin all your Christmas cards. Good night.